Support for the morning show comes from Andrea's, a Kenosha tradition since 1911. A unique shopping experience time and time again, and that's what brings you back. And don't forget about Jack's Cafe, Andrea's, 2401 60th Street, online at andreasgifts.com. Support for the morning show also comes from the Carthage College Office of Continuing Studies, providing graduate and accelerated certification programs in education to start or advance a career in teaching. Convenient evening and summer courses are designed for the working adult. More information is available at carthage.edu/grad. And we welcome you to the Wednesday morning show on WGTD HD, your gateway to public radio. I'm Gregory Berg. I'm so happy to welcome back into our studios a Carthage College faculty colleague of mine, Dr. Thomas Carr, who directs the paleontology program at Carthage, and who joins us, of course, on a fairly regular basis to talk about the various expeditions and excavations that he is part of as a working paleontologist. And he has been part of some very successful and important dinosaur digs out west, and this summer was no exception. And a couple of very exciting opportunities have also come across Dr. Carr's path that he's going to be talking about as well. And he's going to be describing for us as well his blog, which he launched fairly recently, called Tyrannosaurus Central. So we'll find out about all of that and more. And Dr. Carr is not feeling the best, fighting quite a nasty cold from the sounds of it. So we appreciate your presence here. Nevertheless, welcome back to the morning show.
Thank you for having me back.
Good to have you here. Good to have you here, and good luck with the throat. And so first of all, let's kind of recap, particularly for the sake of anybody who has maybe missed our previous conversations. We've had, I feel like, maybe seven or eight by now here on the morning show, a little bit about your own background, where you come from originally, and sort of the path that took you to the exciting world of paleontology.
Well, I'm a faculty member at Carthage College, actually. I'm glad you asked me the question because I have to make a small correction that I'm professor of biology, not anthropology.
Right. Well, right. Yes.
I don't, don't mind so much. I don't hold that much against anthropology, but I am a professor of biology.
There's, right.
Currently, there's a fairly steep difference. And I've been at Carthage since 2004. I was hired to start a paleontology program at the college that consisted of, I guess, three main pillars. The first was helping develop the Dinosaur Discovery Museum that's downtown and developing a field program to dig dinosaurs for students, of course, and also get a lab up and running to train students in how to do, the technical side of vertebrate paleontology in particular. My story, I guess, goes back to when I was 2 years old. I think I'm 47. but the interest in dinosaurs started there.
At the age of two?
At the age of two, according to my mom, so that's one thing I won't fight her on. and that interest came of age. For dinosaurs with children, usually, right in the teenage years, either old things get abandoned or new things, new paths are followed. But I hung in there. And I guess at that age, the interest became academic. And I've, pursued that route and did a master's and a PhD degrees at University of Toronto in Canada. And that's where I'm from originally.
From Toronto, Canada. Is that, in a sense, dinosaur country? I mean, for instance, have there been important dinosaur digs from where you come from?
Well, in the province of Ontario, there's pretty much nothing, but there are rocks of the right age. This is sort of a compelling thing, and people have gone up to look and really haven't found anything. But Canada itself, actually, I should back up. Toronto really is one of the two eastern cities in Canada that feature Canadian dinosaurs in very large dinosaur galleries, sort of comparable to New York and Chicago. So the Royal Ontario Museum was always close, and that kept my interest stoked. And the ROM has been very important in my own life. My undergraduate thesis and graduate work was based on their collections in large part. And I was actually, my office was in the building. So that's it's an important institution, and it was when I was a child and then much later. But to answer your question, Canada is one of the most important places on the planet for collecting dinosaurs, in particular the provinces of Saskatchewan and Alberta. And recently, British Columbia is gaining this distinction in terms of a lot of dinosaur fossils. You know, British Columbia is just, BC's just starting, but Alberta and Saskatchewan are really the hot spots. And I arguably, Alberta is the top of the heap in terms of sheer numbers of excellent dinosaur fossils that are found each year.
Do I remember Alberta is right next to British, that it goes British Columbia, Alberta, Saskatchewan? Am I remembering my provinces correctly?
Yeah.
So if you sort of swept north from our own west, the western United States, it makes sense that that's where they would be found in Canada then.
Yeah, it's continuous. The relatively recent, you know, the deep time geological history was pretty much identical. The Rockies were coming up and lava deposition along the Western Interior Seaway that cut North America in two. And this extended from, you know, the Yukon, Alaska, all the way down to Mexico. You know, this is, you know, a very extensive continent scale event. And you just need the right conditions to preserve the fossils. And then later you need the later erosion to bring those to the surface. And you also need a mammal with a very certain type of consciousness to actually recognize what these things are and pursue their true meaning.
Absolutely. Before we talk about your most recent dinosaur digs and kind of your background in doing that, I'd be really curious to know at what point in your life you began to really think beyond just being interested in dinosaurs and wanting to learn a lot about them, versus wanting to be a paleontologist and even coming to understand what that meant, what a paleontologist did, what the work of this field is all about. At what point did that become more of sort of a hard and fast reality for you?
There was an epiphany. There was a definite moment. I was walking along a wooden walkway outside an ATCO trailer in Dinosaur Provincial Park, Alberta. And I was 18 years old, and I had volunteered for a couple weeks that summer to dig up dinosaurs. And I was walking by the trailers toward the kitchen trailer. And I remember quite clearly having the sensation, not only internally but visually, I guess that's internal anyway, because images are reconstructed in the head. We actually don't really see with our eyes. The images are built up in our brains. But
sure.
I had this crystal clear view and feeling that I belonged here. And that meaning that I belonged in this world of this science and as a researcher. And I felt like I had finally in my life arrived to where I'd been heading for all those years, and the path hasn't always been direct, hasn't always been smooth, but that was the most important moment. And then about half a year later, I decided that, you know, I would study tyrannosaurs, and so there's another sort of little set of events that led to that. But I think it's really important to provide opportunities to the public, to students, to do things like participate in dinosaur digs, participate in, say, prepping fossils in a lab, being a docent at a museum. It doesn't matter. I think people need to be let in, to have that curtain, I guess the opportunity made, you know, given to people to participate, and maybe that curtain in their minds will be lifted of what their true goals and ambitions and passions are. And that certainly happened with me. And I hope that with all the volunteers that pass through our hands coming to dig dinosaurs with us in Montana, that maybe we light a few of those candles too.
For those of you just joining us, I'm speaking with Dr. Thomas Carr, who is professor of biology and director of the paleontology program at Carthage College. And we're about to start talking about the most recent of his dinosaur digs out west. Ahead of us talking specifically about that, how soon after coming to Carthage in 2004 did you begin leading these dinosaur digs? And ahead of coming to Carthage, is that something that you had actually done? I mean, in terms of being the leader of such expeditions.
Right. When I started at Carthage, I had nothing in my hip pocket in terms of the field. The field meaning having a place to go and dig dinosaurs. And I had done field work in Alberta, and off and on. It certainly wasn't as consistent as I wanted it to be. And I look back and I think, you know, I could have been doing more. I should have. But regardless, I wound up here with empty pockets with that expectation. And there's just sort of a whole series of events beyond my control that dropped about 80 to 100 square miles of BLM-managed lands in southeastern Montana in my lap. The way that happened was a group of students from, undergraduate students, no less, from University of Wisconsin-Madison. They had been digging over the course of their undergraduate years, and they all made it into graduate school. I mean, a tremendous group of students, and I'm still in touch with the bulk of them. Well, actually, yeah, in touch with all of them now still. And they were looking around for people or institutions to turn this area over to. And I was lucky to be invited or to have the offer made. And the other institution was the Burpee Museum. So that happened in 2004, I think in February or March. And they took me out in late May, early June of 2005 to survey the area, meet the BLM managers and meet the ranchers. And then in 2006, I started. And we've been going ever since. And we sort of follow a 2 years on, 1 year off schedule. It sort of tracks my J-term obligations.
Right. Explain that term. Was it BLM?
Yeah, that's Bureau of Land Management. It's a branch of the Department of Interior, and they're responsible for managing BLM federally managed lands. So, you know, in Montana, and I'm sure like everywhere else, if you look at maps, they're actually gridded out between BLM federal land, state land, and private. And the BLM can provide the public, since it's the public's land, access to researchers and people doing recreation, you know, depending on what the context is. And so I apply to the BLM each year to get permits to go and collect on lands that they manage, that they hold in trust for all the people of the of this country.
So the place where you go for these, for this primary site for the dinosaur digs then, and I think we've talked about this before, but it's been a little while. So who actually owns that land, and otherwise what is its function, if anything, besides laying wait for you to come back and dig for more dinosaur bones? Otherwise, is the land used in any other way by anybody else?
You own that land, and every citizen...
I mean, we own that. Okay.
Yes, and every citizen of this country own that land. It's your land. And it is managed on your behalf by the federal government. And to in order to ensure the long-term sustainability and ecological health of those lands and the recreational health of those lands, is there's some rules to follow. You know, for example, you just can't start a bonfire in the middle of the driest part of the year. So there's regulations to follow so that those lands are there for you and everybody for all time.
Right.
And where we are, the lands are leased by ranchers, primarily for grazing cattle. There's also a fair amount of agriculture. There's corn and a few other crops. But primarily, it's we're in beef land and cattle land. And so these patches of land under different types of rules are adjacent to each other. So the cattle don't know where they are. And on the ground, you need a map and a GPS unit to know where you are. And we have to know if we're on BLM land or not. And So, as in a nutshell, their lands match for the use of the American public, and that's context dependent.
Hmm. And so, the reason I think it in my mind I didn't have that perfectly clear is because I know we have talked before about the cooperation that is necessary for you to do this, that even if, in fact, it is the federal government that owns these lands, and in many cases, in order for you to have access to where you want to dig or this and that, I mean, it often involves actually interaction with people who I presume maybe own adjacent land and so on.
Yeah, it does, and it's a wonderful thing. I just want to emphasize, it's your land. People of the United States own the land.
Right.
Right. And in terms of boots on the ground, we do meet with our BLM field manager and pick up the permits. We often meet up with him later at the Dino Shindig, which is a public program run by the Carter County Museum in Ekalaka, Montana. And there's a day of digging dinosaurs and a day of public talks given by paleontologists. I'm lucky to say that I've given a talk each year. I keep getting invited back, which is wonderful. We are in the vicinity, so we can make it. And we also interact with the ranchers, too. And we're there either camping or renting a lodge due to their good graces. And it's very, on the whole, I'd say it's a very positive experience. Hmm. And I enjoy it more and more each year, especially in terms of the interaction with the ranchers. It's a very positive interaction. We have their enthusiastic support to the hilt. Hmm. As a matter of fact, they're members of the board of the Carter County Museum, so they're with us. That they really support science and they really want to make the opportunity available, even though we do, cross over their private onto BLM.
Great. Remind us of what you first discovered. Was the first thing you found Clint?
Yeah, three bones of a very small T-Rex nicknamed Little Clint. We've gone back to that locality and we've found nothing else of Little Clint, but we have found remains of two other T-Rex, including a medium-sized adult, a Triceratops. Most of the bones are Triceratops, and bits and pieces of a duckbill. And we didn't go back there this year, but we will continue that dig. But most recently, our main focus was a Triceratops skull, nicknamed Maddie for Madison. It was a nickname for the UW-Madison connection. They actually found it back in 2004. And when they took me out, showed me around, they said, oh, by the way, there's a Triceratops sticking out of this hill, so it's yours now. And so we took it on, I think, in earnest in 2012, and it's taken several summers to get Maddie. And we brought back the last of that skull this year. Most of that work took over the course of a week, and I was sweating bullets. We had delays from rain, and we made it. We brought the last of it in 9:30 p.m. the night before we left.
Wow.
It was a race.
Wow.
To the finish.
What's interesting, on the other hand, is how it wasn't a race to get started, that it was these remains were brought to your attention in 2004, but you let 8 years go by before actually pursuing it then in earnest, I guess because you were occupied with these other facets of the dig. And I suppose that really underscores what a lot of us don't appreciate, namely the slow, painstaking work that we are talking about. I mean, it isn't like you see in the movies.
Not always. It can be like that. I remember watching Jurassic Park in 93. I saw that movie 9 times in a week. And I remember quite clearly sitting in the audience for the 9th midnight showing Thursday night before the wide release. And one of the scenes opens with them just brushing sand off of a dinosaur skeleton. I thought, there's no way. That's Hollywood. But in fact, because I'd worked, field work I've done up to that point was in harder rock, but it can be like that, literally brushing aside sand. And that's pretty treacherous for fossils. You have to be really careful in stabilizing not only the bones but the sand. You have to actually dump glue onto the sand so that you can jack it and take out the skeletons. But it does take a lot of care. It's a long-term commitment. With Maddie, it took so long because it wasn't in danger of erosion. The Madison crew had covered it in tinfoil, and I think may have had a tarp on it as well. So in all, to all intents and purposes, it was winterized.
Hmm. You knew pretty firmly that nothing was going to happen to it in terms of from the elements in the meantime.
Yeah, it was fine. And then I think it was in 2012 when one of my volunteers said, you know, Maddie's fallen apart. There's actually a dislodged piece of bone, and we've got to do something about this. And so we did. It's an ethical. It would be unethical to let it just erode out like that. And I realized, okay, the time has come for this specimen, and we can't put it off any longer because we're losing information. That's what fossils are. They're really information about ancient life and evolution. So ethically, I just couldn't leave it any longer.
Hmm.
And it's a gorgeous skull. I mean, it's going to be quite spectacular once it's all prepared. And we want to mount it and have it on display on campus in the new extension of the Straz building.
Wow. Can't wait for that. Yeah. So how intact was this skull? And at the time that you began going after what remained of it in 2012, how much had already been taken?
Yeah, we picked up everything off the surface, I think. Well, I guess the year doesn't matter, but my impression was the snout was gone. And when we dug in, we realized that the skull actually settled in some mud and had drifted apart. The skull fell apart. Dinosaur skulls don't fuse together like our skulls do, at least not as extensively. And so what we discovered was this sort of boardwalk of Triceratops skull. You know, it's huge sections of frill leading off to the southeast.
Huh.
And in 2014, one of our volunteers made the offhand comment that, oh, by the way, we jacketed the nasal. This is a bone of the snout. And I thought there was no way we would have any snout bones at all because what was on the surface was bits of jaw and such.
So this is someone else telling you what they believed they found.
Yeah, and so we don't know yet, but we do have indications that we do have at least bones of the palate scattered among the big section of the skull that has the horns. So that's toward the front. The palate is ahead of that. And we were just looking at this yesterday. And if these are palate bones, that's consistent with the hypothesis that the entire skull drifted to the southeast. So we may have more than we realize. I don't expect that we'll have the whole snout, but I think we have more than we expect. So it'll be a big Triceratops skull. The base of each orbital horn is as big round as a sort of a tree. I have to do a double take each time I look at it. Huh. You know, it's about a foot. You know, diameter is about a foot. It's amazing.
Just the base of the horn.
Base of the horn.
Wow.
Just from one side to the other. And I forget how big dinosaurs are.
Yeah, and you dig them, but in more ways than one. And how about the horns themselves? I mean, do you have those, and are they relatively intact?
Yeah, we have both. We're missing the tips, but below that, they're attached to what's called the brain case. So that's a set of bones that surround the brain and connect the skull to the neck. And Dr. Megan Seitz and I were discussing this yesterday, that it looks like the brain case has actually been distorted. It's been rotated forward below the horns. Because otherwise, the snout would be sort of angling almost straight down. Without that correction, we have to pull the brain case back.
Mm.
You know, we won't physically do that. But in muds, odd things happen. You know,
right.
As things settle, they deform.
Sure.
So just part of, you know, fossilization is, you know, as normal.
Right.
But we discover new things sort of about the particular, what are called taphonomic aspects of the locality, sort of what happened to the skeleton after it died, settled, and was fossilized.
Huh. Even that process itself is an interesting thing to study, besides what this tells us about what this creature was like when it was alive and walking around.
Yeah.
Interesting.
It's a whole field unto itself, taphonomy is.
You speak with such certainty that you recovered the last of Maddie.
Yeah.
And I'm just curious how you can be so certain of that.
What we did was we trenched around a pretty good distance around the bones that we have, and we didn't run into anything else. You know, there's I guess there's always a possibility of a skeleton being back there, but time will bring it to the surface. You know, so I can wait for that.
Sure.
But on the face of it, we have the whole skull, and if that's all there was at that locality, then we're done. We've seen no evidence yet there was anything else.
Okay.
So I'm pretty sure. I don't really know.
Right.
You know, I'm not, obviously not Superman and don't have X-ray vision. And,
but you're fairly certain.
Yeah, so it's a workable, you know, it's a hypothesis, actually, and it's testable.
Right. What I'm not sure I understand. So you think you have all of Maddie's skull or all that exists.
Yeah.
But the rest of Maddie has to be someplace, doesn't it? And doesn't it presumably, isn't it probably fairly close by to where the skull was? Or is it possible that the skull could have, in a sense, traveled some distance?
Yeah, it looks like the skull has been moved. And skulls tend to be found isolated for Triceratops. There's more skulls than skeletons. And it's kind of unusual to find a skeleton. And that would have been really... We actually have two Triceratops skeletons elsewhere in our area that we want to collect. But Maddie looks like one of these typical lone skulls. And the rest of the skeleton may have just washed away and been eroded to nothing and back 66 million years ago. Or it may have been actually out where the hill now isn't and may have been utterly destroyed. And we actually found a Triceratops snout this summer where that process had happened, that the hill had eroded through a Triceratops skull, leaving only the snout. And one of my students, Justin Coates, he's a student at UW Parkside, found this snout. And so the snout was going into the hill.
Huh.
It was clear that we were several decades too late to get the whole skull.
Mm.
It's a beautiful snout, and it actually has the lower jaws attached as well, which was something that we didn't know at the outset.
So describe the state of what you dug out this summer, that is the last of the skull of Maddie. It's at Carthage now?
Yes, it's in the lab in the Basement Dinosaur Discovery Museum. It's called the Carthage Institute of Paleontology. We brought back a bathtub-sized, or two bathtub-sized field jackets, one containing Maddie's frill, and the other containing Justin's snout. We brought back bunches of other field jackets from other localities, a lot of Triceratops ribs and pelvic bones, and bazillions of smaller fossils like dinosaur teeth and stuff like that. So this year was an incredibly productive summer, and it's going to take us forever to catalog all this, which we have to do for our field report for the BLM. So
how far in the future are we talking in terms of this specimen, this Triceratops skull being ready for public viewing? I mean, are we going to be waiting years for this? Decades?
It won't be decades. Hopefully a couple of years at the most. These things take real time, and the kicker is that we're dependent on volunteers, student volunteers, members of the public, and it's been a real challenge for us to develop a team of volunteers to help us with these things. So sometimes prep takes place really quickly. Other times it takes a lot longer. We don't have a hard timeline for Maddie right now. We have to be realistic. But I think, you know, a couple of years tops.
Wow.
I'm hoping, but yeah, that's a critical aspect for us because we have a backlog of field jackets that go all the way back to 2006.
Yeah.
There's stuff I haven't even seen.
Hmm.
So we really need to build up that end of things, but it takes real time, and we need people who have the time to give.
Mm.
And we do want, you know, for anyone out there who's listening who might be interested, we do expect that people will be able to commit a certain amount of time every week, you know, for, you know, the stretch of a semester or something like that. That's right. Usually a time scale we operate on.
For those of you just joining us, I'm speaking with Dr. Thomas Carr, a professor of biology at Carthage College and director of the paleontology program there. And we need to shift our conversation now from Maddie to another woman, namely Jane, a subadult T-Rex. And you were telling me, Thomas, before we went on the air, that you didn't discover Jane, but your lives have become rather closely entwined ever since. Tell us, first of all, when and where and by whom she was discovered, and how Jane, in a sense, or remains, that is, of course, became such an important part of your academic work.
I'll start by saying that Jane is one of those fossils that I think come around once in a lifetime. Hmm. It's a truly spectacular specimen that was found in 2001 by volunteers of the Burpee Museum of Natural History. Burpee Museum is in Rockford, Illinois. And it's sort of the little museum that could. And and Jane really put the Burpee on the map. I mean, we're talking a virtually perfectly preserved subadult Tyrannosaurus rex, the likes of which had never been found before.
And how so? In what way had nothing like this been seen before, in terms of it being so complete, such a perfect specimen?
Yeah, in terms of quality of preservation and completeness, it's almost all there. There's a couple regions of the skull that aren't there. There's several vertebrae that are missing, and we don't have the whole arm or hand. But what is there really fills in the picture of what a young T-Rex really looks like. Hmm. Up until Jane, there's a relatively complete skull, a smaller skull, that is in Cleveland, in the Cleveland Museum of Natural History. It was found actually close to where we dig, and Jane, for that matter, back in 1942, by the Cleveland Museum, and a little snout that was found by the Los Angeles County Museum further north in Montana. So in terms of young T-Rex, we've really had a tantalizing view of what they looked like, heavily biased toward the skull, and Jane actually brought to the picture an undistorted skull and most of the skeleton. Hmm. And that's really thrown the early development of T-Rex in sharp relief. Although it is one data point, and by no stretch is Jane a juvenile. It's around 21 feet long, half grown, essentially, in terms of size. But it's an extremely valuable window scientifically on how T-Rex grew up and evolved.
Hmm. So what has your sort of hands-on involvement been with Jane, and how did that come about?
Yeah, the Burpee Museum realized what they had. They had no illusions about the scientific importance of Jane, and they really got a lot of mileage out of it in terms of publicity and expanding exhibits, that sort of thing. So it's really, Jane has been a boon for the museum. And they also wanted the scientific potential of Jane to be realized. And a description of Jane, sort of the way science works, is when you find something new and spectacular, you write a scientific description of it that tells scientists what it is, the reasons for why thinking that, and also giving a complete written and illustrated view of what it looks like, so to share the data. And the description of Jane was started back in early 2000s and really never got off the ground. And the person at the helm was actually an invertebrate paleontologist. He likes working on Maison Creek things, like very early invertebrates, things like the Tully Monster and millipedes, actually. Hmm. And so he had the project. And I really hope he doesn't mind me disclosing all of this. So he had the project, and he brought it to a certain level of maturity. And in his own life, some things changed. He started a new PhD program or a new focus for his PhD that shifted back to invertebrates where his heart really belonged. And so Jane was sort of left in a lurch.
Mm.
And I was lucky enough that he gave me a call and said, hey, you know, I'm taking this new direction. Do you mind taking Jane off my hands?
Wow.
And, yeah.
As if you had to phrase it as a question.
Yeah. And he was very, very sweet about it and said that, you know, among the people who have come to examine Jane, he was impressed with the time that I took, the care that I took, and the amount of sheer volume of data that I took from Jane. He saw that I would really, at least in his mind, would really do the specimen justice. And so what started as a 30, 40-page manuscript is now 800-plus. It's a huge description. It's a thorough, exhaustive, and comparative description of Jane. It will be, I think, probably will be the largest description of a dinosaur ever published.
Wow.
And that 800-page count is excluding the illustrations and the tables, which bump it up well over 1,000
wow.
pages.
Wow.
So it's going to be something that no one in their right mind would ever want to read.
but you've written it nevertheless. Mm-hmm. So when we're talking about that kind of focus of detail, I think for those of us on the outside looking in, we can scarcely imagine that there's 800 pages of stuff to say about one specimen.
Yeah.
But so try to help us understand
there's a couple,
the kind of details that you're illuminating in this.
Yeah, there's a couple of reasons for that. The first of which is that the science of paleontology has reached the moment in history where we have so much data. We have so much more knowledge than we did, say, even just a few decades ago about dinosaurs' extinct life, that it's no longer acceptable, at least to my mind, to write brief summative descriptions of new and important specimens, be they new species or fill in some gap in a growth series like Jane does. And so I just thought this is a great opportunity to go all the way and actually just bring description that much further. And, you know, when people talk about a monograph, at least in my field, it's something that's, you know, at most a couple hundred pages, but on average 70 to 100. And, you know, I've upped that by an order of magnitude. Now, the monograph itself isn't just Jane. You know, just one specimen has no context. So what I've actually done is I've taken the opportunity to describe the growth series of T-Rex based on all of the specimens available. So the little L.A. baby is in there, sort of starting, you know, as the earliest growth stage. Little Clint is in there.
Hmm.
The Cleveland skull is in there, Jane, and then then representative adults. And so I'm actually describing in stark raving detail the growth of T-Rex with a very heavy emphasis on Jane, but that gives the context and meaning of that specimen.
Right.
Otherwise, it would just be, you know, I think too brief and not just not providing enough context regarding the specimen. You know, these things cannot be any longer viewed in isolation. And along the way, what we do is work on the evolution of dinosaurs, and that's based on building family trees based on a lot of data. And so there's been some intense work being done on Tyrannosaurs recently. So in the growth series, in this description, I include all of that. So I mentioned that in every specimen, whether we see a primitive feature or an advanced one, to give it depth. So the description now has a phylogenetic, technically it's called an evolutionary depth to it. So, you know, Jane has a lot of teeth. What does that mean in terms of growth? What does that mean in terms of the deep evolutionary patterns in this group? So not only is there the one layer of what does Jane look like in comparison with everything else, there's a deeper layer of how is T-Rex itself, how did it evolve, and how does the growth reflect that?
Mm. how the difference between a young T-Rex and a mature T-Rex, is that at all a parallel to earlier T-Rex versus later T-Rex?
That's brilliant. That's and the short answer is yes.
Yeah.
Absolutely. And with T-Rex and every other vertebrate, juveniles essentially look more like ancestors than they do the species, because the species identifying features haven't grown in yet.
Fascinating. And this is too big a question to ask you at 8:52, and we're over at 9 o'clock, but when we look at the way a T-Rex develops through the course of its life, we presume, from baby to youngster to adolescent to adult, can you point to something in our own age that roughly approximates it? I mean, I guess another way to ask this is, does it appear that it grew and developed through the course of its lifetime in ways that would be, in a sense, fairly expected?
Yes. Yeah, in this sort of ancestral to descendant transition, you can see in any vertebrate. You know, if you just look at the growth series, this is something that I have my own students work on. Just pick something, and you'll see the same general trend.
So there's, in a sense, there's nothing groundbreaking about that. It's not that you have discovered that to be true, but you are charting the specifics of how it happens to be true with T-Rex then.
Yeah, I'm charting it out for the first time using all of the data available. So that's part of the motivation to do the monograph, because I think there's no excuse left for us not to do that.
Right. We are in a position to do that now, and we weren't even 10 years ago, certainly not 20 or 30 years ago.
And we ought to take advantage of that and really actually take our job seriously and not just sort of spin off these shorter articles. I mean, I'm guilty of that too. But when the opportunity presents itself, it's something that is, I think, worth the effort.
Yeah.
Because, you know, because that's something for people of the future to draw on as well.
So where is the monograph at this point in time? Yeah. I mean, is it finished?
No. The short answer is no. But it does have a publisher, which is fantastic. That's something that happened out of the blue during the spring semester. I got an email one morning in March, I think, saying, hey, we heard that you're working on a couple big projects. Could we publish them for you? And I said, yeah. And they wanted to do Jane first. Right now, I'm just doing the final revisions to the manuscript. So I'm working on it daily. You can follow my progress on my blog. My blog is called Tyrannosauroidea Central, and I just every few days or every week or so, I add entries for the Jane Diaries. So working on the 53rd entry, guaranteed to put you to sleep. If the title doesn't do that to you.
If insomnia is a problem.
Yes, it's a surefire cure for insomnia.
Now, can we just Google your name and be drawn to that website, or should we get the full title of it and properly spelled?
I think you can Google my name. You can also Tyrannosauroidea Central as one word. You might even just want to write Tyrannosaur Central, if that's more straightforward. But yeah, just look around and you'll find it. The Jane Diaries.
The Jane Diaries. I like that quote.
You should find it there, too.
I don't think we've yet touched on the fact that you're about to head down to Dallas and present on Jane.
Yeah.
And will that be kind of a summation of all this, or are you aiming at a particular point in your presentation in Dallas?
Yeah.
And what is that for? And what is it for?
Right. The meeting's in Dallas. It's the annual meeting of the Society of Vertebrate Paleontology. And so that's where all the paleontologists and students and interested public will go and hear formal presentations given by scientists regarding their recent work. And so I landed a talk this year to present on Jane. It's just not me. It's me along with a whole string of people who are attached to the original description of Jane. So it's not just me, although I have, you know, I'm responsible for the 1,000 additional pages. So it's presenting the primary results of Jane, its maturity in terms of how old it is in terms of years, and its relative maturity based on features of the skeleton, and also its bearing on I call it a pseudo-controversy regarding a Tyrannosaur called Nanotyrannus. Nanotyrannus, to make a very long and boring story short, Nanotyrannus is a misidentified juvenile T-Rex. Mm. I demonstrated that back in 99. There's people who still think Nanotyrannus is real. It's sort of like my, in terms of evolutionary biology battles creationism, I battle Nanotyrannus. And so I put a very fine point on how Jane sheds some light on this pseudo-controversy that Nanotyrannus is as dead as a doornail as it ever was. And there's nothing we see in Jane that changes that hypothesis.
Hmm. So in a sense, Jane helps confirm what you had suspected to be the case all along. I mean, it makes the case even firmer in a sense.
It does. There's no data in the skeleton that contradicts the original hypothesis that Nanotyrannus, which is based on the Cleveland skull, is really a T-Rex.
Right.
And what's, to make a long story short, Jane actually shares more features in common with adult T-Rex than it does with the younger animals, which is what we should expect to see of a larger, more mature animal that's headed in the T-Rex direction. We actually see a whole slew of features shared with adults that you don't see in, say, the Cleveland skull.
By the way, is Jane on display? I mean, if we went to that museum in Rockford, is it mounted and can be viewed?
Yeah, please go. I encourage everyone, if you haven't already, to go to Rockford and visit the Burpee Museum. Jane has its own exhibit.
Hmm.
It's a gorgeous skeleton. It's sort of the centerpiece. It's surrounded by examples of other fossils found close to Jane or in the vicinity that the Burpee Museum's collected. There's also another beautiful little display they have of a triceratops, a young triceratops nicknamed Homer. Hmm. There's a beautiful display of horned dinosaur evolution and also other fossils found from the Hell Creek Formation. Huh. They're just right next door to where we collect.
Wow.
So you'll get a sense of what we're collecting, too.
Great.
Well, it's a gem.
Yeah, that's worth visiting then in Rockford, the Burpee Museum.
Yes.
Dr. Thomas Carr, boy, you have been busy, and it's great to see such exciting things coming your way that this hard work is resulting in such exciting new accomplishments for you. And so we wish you well with the presentation in Dallas and the publication of this spectacular new monograph, and, of course, your ongoing work on the skull of